Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the press conference of the Cycling Podcast on the Tour de France. Questions in French and English only, questions en français et en anglais uniquement. No questions will be taken on the Anglo-French relationship.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney, laughing Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Francois Tomazo.
Hi there.
We're convening, chaps, on Saturday morning before the time trial stage of the Tour de France that will settle this year's tour, to record our third press conference where we listen to your questions that you've phoned in and try to answer them as best we can. So let's just crack on with that, shall we? Let's have the first question.
Gents, Simon from Sydney here. I noticed during your Giro coverage that the introductory voice was that of a young Italian lady, whilst during the Tour, you have a young French lady. Yet during your coverage of the Women's Tour in the UK, it was an English gentleman. I'm just wondering, is this the cycling podcast equivalent of the Podium Girls? And what is your stance on that subject?
Well, Simon, that's an interesting question. In terms of Podium Girls, let me refer you to a kilometre zero that we did last year, that Orla Shinawy did for the cycling podcast at the Tour de France last year, which was a pretty balanced episode, I think, on the subject, when we heard from Podium Girls and also from people opposed to Podium Girls, including Ashley Milman-Passio, the writer, who made some very good points. It's an interesting, thought-provoking listen. In terms of the voiceover artists, if I can call them that, well, the English gentleman is Rob Hatch, the Eurosport commentator. He does the cycling podcast Femina voiceover stuff. My wife will be delighted to be described as a young lady. She does the Tour de France voiceover. That's her voice we hear at the start and throughout the episode. My brother's wife does the Vuelta, giving away all our secrets here. I think we like to have a female voice for our regular shows, because there's a lot of male voices in them, and it's just a bit of contrast, something a bit different. And similarly for the cycling podcast Femina, because we hear a lot of female voices in that show, we thought a male voice would offer a contrast and stand out a little bit. I think that's the reason. I don't think we'd given it too much thought, really, had we, Lionel?
No, I mean, when it comes to our regular kind of episode furniture, the voice artist was someone who was recommended to us by one of our producers. So, that was how that came about.
And just going right back to, I mean, the origins of the podcast, when we started in 2013, our first outing was the Tour de France, and we just thought it'll be nice to have a French accent for that. And I happen to live with a French accent, and so I asked to do it, and she's done it ever since, for which we're very grateful.
A community around the world, stories and films with the most compelling characters, the world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Hi, it's Fleck from Rafa. At Rafa, we believe that cycling transforms lives, and that cycling is the answer to many of our daily problems and challenges. For me, it gives me the headspace to think about the people dearest to me and focus on the most important things in life. It's amazing where your mind goes when you give it time to wonder. We have 23 Rafa clubhouses around the world with 300 rides a week with thousands of people. So wherever you are, we invite you to ride with us. Head to rafa.cc to find a ride near you.
Thank you to Rafa, whose title sponsorship of the cycling podcast has allowed us to travel around France and report on the Tour de France in the way that we have. Again, thank you very much indeed to them. Let's have another question, shall we?
Sam from Derbyshire in the UK. I just wanted to vent my annoyance about what happened on the road to Alpe d'Huez yesterday, where we lost Nibali to motos and overcrowding. We hear sporting directors complain about the cobbles, but as we've seen in the past, one of the biggest dangers are these unruly fans and the accidents they cause on these iconic climbs. Losing one of the few cyclists who's proven to last the 3 weeks for the sake of pictures of men running up the road in speedos doesn't seem worth it. Is it time for some bigger changes? Yes, they banned alcohol, but they need to tackle overcrowding and they need to find a better way to police these roads. Otherwise, we're compromising the race. What a shame it is that we're not going to see the shark in the final part of this tour. Somebody who really could have challenged Froome, Thomas, Dumoulin, even going into the last few days. Thank you.
Yeah, obviously a very unfortunate incident for Vincenzo Nibali, and you could argue for the race. I would say the crowds on Alpe d'Huez and most of the big climbs have been smaller. I'm not necessarily sure overcrowding is a problem. I think there's an issue with the number of motorbikes accompanying the riders, but some of those are additional motorbikes to try and secure their safety. I'm not quite the old man of the podcast yet, Francois, but you know, you don't have to go back all that long. 1999, Giuseppe Guerini was knocked off by a spectator taking a photograph on Alpe d'Huez. He fortunately managed to get back up and won that stage. And 2003, Lance Armstrong caught his handlebars on a spectator's bag and went down. So these incidents have always kind of happened. I mean, it's part of the risk of the mountain. If you ride close to the spectators, there's an increased risk of having a problem. I think culturally, people behave differently on the mountain compared to even 30 years ago. Lots of pictures were put on social media of very well-behaved crowds, and certainly my impression, and this is only kind of anecdotal, but you know, it's not that long ago that the crowd would be in the middle of the road as the riders approached and then would take a step back as they actually came past and give the riders space. That doesn't seem to happen anymore. And I was talking to Dave Brailsford the other morning, and he thinks that the sort of selfie culture is one aspect. People want to take their pictures and often want to get themselves in the pictures as well, and that's where a lot of trouble arises. And of course, as soon as people started running alongside in either in, you know, fancy dress or not in fancy dress, that becomes something that then others want to copy. And I think they could maybe ban running alongside the riders. It would be tricky to enforce, but that would be a first step, I think, before they considered even more barriers, because I think once you've got the whole of these climbs barriered, the race will lose something that's actually really important, and that is the interaction between the crowd and the riders. Visually, it would look terrible if they just barriered the whole of Alpe d'Huez or the whole of these climbs. But you know, clearly it's you know, there is a there's an acceptable level of risk and an unacceptable level of risk, and I don't necessarily think that there was. Just because Nibali fell off because of a motorbike, I don't necessarily think that they've got it too far wrong this year. I don't think it's as bad as it has been in previous years.
I think it's a dangerous sport. It's on open roads with spectators, and it's as you said, Lionel, it's part of the sport. I mean, the climbers complain about the crowd and the you know, the unfortunate accidents and crashes, and the sprinters complain about, you know, GC leaders sprinting to the line with them, and it makes it dangerous. So what are we supposed to do? In sprints, we will the other riders will be you know, asked to stop riding with 3Ks to go so that the sprinters can have safe sprints. And then in the mountains, we have barriers from top to from bottom to top on L'Alpe d'Huez. Well, you know what? We almost had it this year. The first 4Ks of the Alpe d'Huez were barriered, and the last 4Ks of the Alpe d'Huez were barriered. One of these days, we'll have barriers from bottom to top, and then cycling will be probably an immaculate sport, but a very boring one. So I don't know. It's very tricky. I said it before on the podcast. I think there's about 20,000 gendarmes used on the roads of the Tour de France. What to do? Put 50,000 gendarmes, or and put a gendarme, you know, running behind each rider to protect his security. It seems to me, and I think David Miller tweeted about it, about the gendarmes on Twitter a few days ago. There's a lot that's been done to ensure the security of the riders, but also of the crowds. Never forget that. I mean, it's a miracle that you don't have, spectators hit by cars or publicity caravan or everything. But in this sort of, it's such a huge event that I don't think you can have a risk-free Tour de France.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you, Science in Sport, for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. And you can still get 25% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com. with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Next question, please.
Hi, this is friend of the podcast, Mark, in Malpit Hill in Kent. I've loved all your podcasts from the tour and also your Kilometre Zero features, especially the one featuring Rod Ellingworth. And I was wondering whether Rod is just someone who doesn't want public recognition for what he's done, or whether there has been, in my opinion at least, a very bad oversight. As far as I know, he has done so much for British cycling, but from what I can gather, Rod was very much a huge part of that. Yet he's never received an MBE or something similar. I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. Thanks very much. Keep up the good work.
Thanks for that, Mark. Rod Ellingworth, I think you make a good point. I mean, the other point is that Rod has been involved centrally for a long time. We don't hear much of him in the media, and partly that's just his personality. He's not particularly comfortable in the spotlight. He doesn't crave it. He doesn't want it. I mean, I think, Lionel, you asked him the other day whether he'd listened to the Kilometre Zero episode, because it did have a lot of feedback from people who weren't really familiar with his story and with what he'd done from the British Academy onwards. And he'd started listening to it but turned it off because he couldn't stand the sound of his own voice. And that really sums up Rod. There isn't really an ego with him. He's very driven. He was a rider himself in the 90s. I used to race with him, actually. He rode for Ambrosia Creamed Rice. And there was a team sponsored by Creamed Rice Company. So he rode for them for a while. And, a modest racing career. And it was as a coach with setting up the British Academy and working with Cavendish, Ian Stannard, Geraint Thomas, Ben Swift and the rest, that he really began to build a reputation as a coach and quite a disciplinarian. You know, he drove them pretty hard. It's well worth reading Mark Cavendish's first book, Boy Racer, and also Rod's own book, Project Rainbow, for some insights into his coaching.
Yeah, I've known Rod a long time. I mean, when I started at Cycling Weekly, reporting the domestic scene, he was still a rider. I think he'd just come back from a year or two racing in France. He was at a French club.
Troyes. He rode with Jacques André's club. UVC Orb, I think?
Yeah, UVC Orb, it was that, yeah. And I remember, just seeing him, he was one of those guys, he'd turn up at a race with his bike in the back of the car and he'd get changed in the... in the toilets and, it's just bike racing, isn't it? Just get stuck in. And I think, then when I kind of, he became a very good contact in those years when he was running the British Cycling Academy, and his kind of ethos shone through, that he wanted to, on the one hand, give these young riders an opportunity that really no generation of British riders had had before, which was to go and have the full immersive experience racing and learning European cycling, so they could survive and thrive in it, but without, them having to do it completely on their own. And so there was a kind of a support network there. But on the other hand, he was encouraging them to be independent and decision makers. And, he'd make the riders do all the logistics when they were going to a race. You know, what time are we leaving? You decide when we're leaving. You decide the punishments or the penalties if we're if somebody's 5 minutes late. You've got to get us to the ferry port, or you know, and what have you. And he would force the riders to think for themselves off the bike, and think for themselves in the race, and all sorts of little sort of gems from Rod over the years that, you know, he. They sound almost. Sounds like it's sort of trying to be kind of superior to others. But that really wasn't the reason he was doing it. But you know, in when the British Academy riders were racing in Italy, he was like, "Look, we're not going to be holding onto cars and doing what the Italian amateur riders are doing, because when you get into the big races, you're not going to be able to do that. The job is to become a professional rider, not" just get a contract. And I think he identified that very early on. And when you look at the graduates from that, you know, the early intake, Mark Cavendish and Geraint Thomas are contemporaries of one another and have had, you know, careers at a very, very high level for a decade. And a lot of that is down to the work that Rod Ellingworth did. But he is not, I have no grounds for this whatsoever, but it would not surprise me if Rod were offered an MBE, if he said, "Oh no, I don't need one of those." I don't know. That's just the kind of character he strikes me as.
And I think we'll see quite a few of his proteges become good coaches. The first of those, Mark Bramier, who's just retired as a pro. He's become an endurance coach for British Cycling, and I think we'll see that happen quite a lot. Quite a lot of these guys will turn into good coaches. And I mean, it wasn't for everybody, his system. Adam Blythe famously didn't work out for him. He didn't like the structure of it. He didn't like they were taught French and they had to sit in a classroom and learn stuff as well as just riding their bikes, and not everybody liked that. So it wasn't for everybody, but those for whom it worked and who committed to it did seem to benefit from it.
Morning, guys. Richard Hignett from sunny Surrey here. Keep up the good work. Really enjoying the podcast. I'm new to it this year, but loving every minute of it. Bit of a greedy question, a two-parter. Do you take your bikes out with you whilst you're covering the Tour de France, or is this a calorie positive only 3 weeks? And second question, if you were able to design your perfect stage, what would it be? Thanks.
Thanks for that question, Richard. Well, Lionel, you brought your bike, didn't you?
I did, yeah, and it's been an almost total failure this year. Probably logistically the worst setup tour in terms of managing to get out on my bike. I managed to ride the first 3 days, but the last time was a quick lap of the team time trial course in Cholet with Tom Carey, a colleague from the Telegraph, on the opening Monday. And since then, the bike has basically stayed in Tom's car. So he's driven my bike around France for me. We've not been staying in the same hotels as Tom very much in the second half of the tour, so we've just not had the opportunity. But I think he's managed to get out a few times. My record for going for a bike ride, I think, was last year. Managed to go out 10 mornings, so roughly every other day, averaged out at us. But yeah, it's not been a great tour this year for doing any exercise. So it probably is calorie positive.
What do you mean, probably? I mean, it's definitely calorie positive, I think, for us as well, hasn't it, Francois?
Well, I must confess to our dear listeners, as Chiro would say, I never ride my bike because I don't have a bike. I never ride bikes. I hate riding bikes.
It's bullshit.
And I will never ride a bike. No, it's true. Unfortunately, I was a runner when I was younger and not a rider. And my body shape, because one of the questions was about body shapes, doesn't quite fit in with bike riding. So yeah, as far as I'm concerned, no bike riding at all.
I began running again this year on the advice of a doctor that I consulted. sounded a bit dodgy, didn't it? A legit doctor. He suggested that I start running again, and I did. And I did quite a lot of running at the Giro, but unfortunately, I suffered a heel injury on the eve of the tour. I've got a problem with a tendon in my heel, and I haven't been able to run at all. I've got some rehab exercises that I've been doing, not that religiously, but definitely calorie positive.
We do about 15,000 steps a day, though, don't we, according to the app on my phone anyway. So, I mean, that's what's the recommended made-up limit that or made-up guideline?
10,000.
Is that right? Is there any scientific basis for that at all, or is it just because it's a nice round number?
No, I think it's actually been calculated and examined and proved beyond any reasonable doubt that 10,000. If you do 9,999, you're failing. No, we do a lot of walking and actually more at the Giro than at the Tour because it's, for some reason it's more spread out. But yeah, walking from the car to the press center to the buses, back to the press center, back to the car, it does add up. So that does keep you reasonably active, but it's not a healthy 3 weeks sitting in a car for hours, eating a lot and not doing very much exercise.
No, I always have a sort of 2 week detox and training camp straight after the Tour. Just ride my bike every day. I'm going to extend that to the full 4 week gap between the Tour and Vuelta and see if I can bring my body shape down from current day Evgeny Berzin to a track sprinter's type shape,
extra large egg to medium egg. Francois, have you ever had a kind of exercise routine or any kind of rituals on the Tour to keep you healthy?
Never. I'll tell you why. Because the stress of covering the Tour and provide the best possible podcast for our listeners, the adrenaline that flows because of it, you know, means that I'm serious there. I don't put on weight on the Tour, ever. Because the rest of the year, you know, being more or less of a writer, I tend to be a little bit too sedentary. And on the Tour, you're always running around, chasing riders, jumping into the car, doing things, being active, moving around. And I think I burn fat very easily, so I don't put on weight on the Tour at all.
And the second part to Rich's question, the perfect Tour de France stage. What would be the perfect Tour de France stage? I mean, I think it already exists. I think these stages in the Massif Central up to Mond are consistently stages that I really enjoy. There was a beautiful stage last year as well that was won by Bauke Mollema that we drove. Where was that, Francois?
It was in Aubrac. There was the region where Romain Bardet hails from. And yeah, it was that's the kind of stages we like because the scenery, I mean, the landscapes are just smashing. You've got lots of little hills and sometimes very hard climbs mixed with, you know, it's very varied. And it's actually the sort of you know, stages that suit the versatile riders like Greg Van Avermaet or even Sagan in many times. And even a Chris Froome can win a stage like this. So these are the kind of stages that actually could suit almost everybody except the very burly sprinters. And, of course, they're probably the most exciting ones.
I don't really look at the stages in isolation like that. I think the Tour is a collection of stages. It's like a box set, isn't it? And you get some really good episodes and then you get a dud episode. What I struggle with is that kind of change of pace. I have no problem with the transitional stages, particularly in recent years when they've gone through the Massif Central and they've been sort of tricky, gnarly climbs and twisty, turny routes. And particularly this year, the stages that got us over from the Alps to the Pyrenees were stunning to look at. The one that I really struggled with was the flat stage into Po on Thursday. So we'd had a couple of mountain stages and then to my mind a completely needless flat stage just sort of chucked in there. I understand logistics, I understand, you know, an extra mountain stage may well have been too much, but it just completely disrupted my rhythm. I found it quite hard knowing that, well, this is going to be a break and then a chase and then a bunch sprint after the rhythm of the mountain stages where you know that something interesting is going to happen. So I'd have liked to have skipped that one personally.
I'd like to see some dirt roads sometimes. I mean, the Roubaix stage was excellent this year. The Trobro-Leon is a race you know well, Lionel, and it uses some of the dirt roads. I think that's going to happen at some point in the Tour.
Yes, there's a rumour that they might go up a 2 kilometre, you know, very, very, very basic dirt road at the top of the Tourmalet. I don't know, you know, if there's grounds to the rumor, but I know the place, I know the road. It would be really, really, really hellish to go up there. But going back to the ideal stage, I like the Vuelta stages, like the ones, you know, with a kind of kind of flat, a little bit of hills, and a final short final hill at the finish. The problem is geography. We don't have that many stages, that many hills that would suit that format in France. And when we do like Montfaron in Toulon, that used to be a feature of Paris-Nice and other races, it's impossible to stage Tour de France stage on those hills, because at the top of them there's not enough room to for the tour caravan and the zone technique, and so it makes it very difficult on the tour to have the same kind of stages as you have on the Vuelta. And that's probably a shame, but I mean, geography can't be changed, can it?
We'll finish with a question that we've been emailed. It's relevant after Friday's stage, which was won by Primoz Roglic, and Tom Dumoulin complained about him getting pacing from the motorbikes. Rick Chase emailed to ask us about motorbikes, motos, falsifying race results, and why journalists and fans care so little about TV motorbikes, yet get so upset about an inhaler with debatable advantages. Well, obviously, talking there about the Chris Froome case, but I mean, you made the point in the podcast yesterday, Lionel, that Jonathan Vauter said that the biggest influence in races on results is motorbikes. Francois, you made the point yesterday's podcast that Primoz Roglic got himself into a situation where he was able to chase the TV motorbike. He was off the front. I mean, I actually, watching the stage, I didn't really notice that Roglic was that close to the motorbikes. It was something that Dumoulin did complain about. I've seen worse examples of it, and you cannot blame Roglic for chasing the motorbikes. It's the motorbike's job to get out of his way, but at the same time, it's also the motorbike's job to get good TV pictures. So it's a very difficult one. I have to say, looking back at old race footage, especially in the 80s, there seems to be far more traffic. Especially in some races, if you watch old clips of races in the 80s, there's a mass of cars and motorbikes often just in front of the breakaway. So it's always been an issue, and it just has to be managed better. But on a descent like that, where the motorbike can barely go faster than the rider, it's extremely difficult. I don't know what you do about it.
I mean, it's, as you say, it's been slimmed down considerably in the 70s and 80s. There were not only twice as many motorbikes on the race, especially for photographers or radio guys. There were also twice as many cars. I mean, all the journalists were driving on the course, and these days almost no journalist is driving the course anymore. So it's changed considerably. Maybe. I'm not going to blame the riders, because you can never blame the riders. They're the main actors of the race. But there was kind of a discipline in the old days where the motorbikes were staying on the right hand side of the road, and the peloton too, leaving a kind of a passage on the left, so that motorbikes and cars could overtake more easily. My impression these days is that the bunch is spread all over the place. The motorbikes are spread all over the place. There's no more discipline on the way all this is organized, which might cause the problem. Remember, two or three years ago, there was a question. A couple of times, motorbikes were involved in accidents with riders, and there was already great concern about it. But in some of these instances, the riders were not entirely blamed about these incidents. So it's a tricky one. What to do? Drones to film the race? But then maybe the drones would be used as well, to pace the riders. I don't know. I can't see a real solution to that.
Drone doping, invisible wires connecting riders to powerful drones.
I think the biggest problem with drones is that they would crash, or something would go wrong with them, or what have you. But I mean, that technology may well evolve to a point where, again, it's about risk and reward. What is an acceptable level of risk? And I think once drone technology advances far enough to reduce the risk of something going wrong, they'll trial it, and then it may well become a fixture in the future. As for the motorbikes, I think it's about a greater level of awareness of just how beneficial the drag effect, the slipstream effect from the motorbikes can be, and just how far back, you know, because the motorbikes are cutting through the air, they're quite big and bulky, and they're punching a good hole through the air, and then you know, that is you know, even if it looks like it's quite a long way off, you know, there could still be a benefit for the riders. But you've got to kind of say, well, they are part of the race. We do see, particularly on Milan San Remo, I think that's one race where you always see the you know, if there's a break up the road and somebody you know, somebody's chasing, you might see a rival rider just behind the chase getting frustrated that the motorbikes are too close. I think it's that, it's kind of almost self-policing. If the riders make a fuss, if the riders make comments about it, then you can be reasonably sure that you know, that there's a problem. It would be wonderful to say, oh, let's have a minimum distance and say, right, they're not allowed to be within X number of metres, but totally unenforceable. You could bring that rule in and it would be broken on the first day of racing just because of circumstances, just because of the complexity of everybody moving around.
And maybe as well, I mean, there have been complaints by the riders, you know, of pacing behind or drafting behind the motorbikes. And other days you have complaints from the riders that the motorcycles were barring, blocking the way, and they were in the way, and so slowing them. So maybe there's a balance there. You know, sometimes they use the slipstream of the motorbikes, and other times the motorbikes are in the way and you know, prevent them from attacking. So that's probably, you know, sometimes they're happy that there are motorbikes, and sometimes they're not. But what to do?
I would never blame a rider for trying to get some advantage off a motorbike if he's off the front. I mean, that he's not going to voluntarily sit on the other side of the road in the wind, is he?
If you've ever been in a team car behind a rider in a time trial, often the sports director will shout, if they're talking through the earpiece, will be saying, chase a bike, because there'll be a security bike just ahead. And if the motorbike moves to the right-hand side of the road, the rider will invariably move to the right-hand side of the road, partly because the motorbike's taking the shortest line through the course as well. So, you know, there's logic to that. But partly because of this kind of, you know, however small the effect may be, there is a benefit to a vehicle going through the air before you.
There's also a benefit having a car behind you, as Chris Boardman has spoken about in the prologue in 94. The car followed very closely behind him because there's an aerodynamic effect from that as well. Almost cost him his leg in 95 when he crashed and the car almost ran over him.
Yeah, the way I've seen this described is that it's sort of the vehicle makes a kind of an air pocket, and you want that. Well, the theory on that particular day, it was the prologue in Saint-Brieuc, wasn't it? The theory was, if the team car was right on his back wheel, it prevents the air pocket from closing behind the rider. It closes behind the car and kind of like basically less air resistance for the rider. But so, I mean, the people who've studied the effects of aerodynamics, you know, will know an awful lot more about this than me. But it's kind of it's one of those controllable uncontrollables about professional cycling. I think it's about the riders will speak up when they think that a result has been falsified. But like Francois says, six of one, half a dozen of another.
We should wrap things up. We're in the Basque country. There are lots of X's and Z's and in the place names. We should finish. We did launch a competition a couple of weeks ago to find a nickname for Peter Sagan or Sagan. It's not gone that well. I mean, lots and lots of suggestions, but it's proving difficult to find a nickname for Peter Sagan. But I did offer a book, A Journey Through the Cycling Year, the Cycling Podcast book, to the best suggestion. I'm going to pick Lee Taylor's suggestion just because it was quite original. I've not heard it before. The not-so-Slovak. I quite like that. It's not going to catch on. We're not going to start calling him that in the podcast, are we? We're as likely to start calling Geraint Thomas G, I would think. But anyway, Lee, you win that competition, Lee Taylor. So please drop us an email, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Just a couple of little reminders of Friends Special episodes coming out. We've got Orla Shinnewy's day with Rod Ellingworth. It was on the day of the Alpe d'Huez stage. It was won by Geraint Thomas. Some of that featured in a Kilometre Zero but there was a lot more material from that day, so that's coming out as a Friends special. We've got an extended conversation with Andy Schleck, and we've got Ian Boswell's diary from the Tour de France, all coming for Friends of the Podcast. You can sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com, and thank you to everyone who has. That's all for now. That's all from us. That's all from Francois. Thank you, Francois.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure to have you again.
No, it's been a pleasure to be with you guys.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You have been listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France. Thanks to our sponsors, Rafa and Science in Sport. The music is by Santoré.